Welcome to the Unfiltered Podcast with me, Joe Warner, and powered by Ultimate Performance, the world's premier personal training experience that delivers maximum results in minimum time. In each episode of the Unfiltered Podcast, I interview the most respected, celebrated, and controversial experts in the fields of health, fitness, nutrition, well-being, and performance to help you find the life-changing advice you need to live smarter. Remember, you can find all of our exclusive Unfiltered documentaries, video interviews, and investigations at unfilteredonline.com and the Unfiltered Extra YouTube channel. And now, on with the show.
Dr. Lufkin, I wanted to start with talking about your book. Now, I know it's not out yet, but could you tell me a little bit about your motivations for wanting to write the book in the first place? Tell us the title and just a little bit about it.
Thanks, Joe. The title is Lies I Taught in Medical School. It's sort of a provocative title, but I wanted to get the message across. The reason I wrote it was because I'm a medical school professor. I've spent essentially my entire career at medical schools, and I still am at medical schools teaching. And about 10 years ago, I came down with four chronic diseases that were fairly common, but they were diseases that when I went to the healthcare system, I was prescribed drugs for them, prescription medicines, and I started those drugs and all. But what I realized, those diseases that I came down with were the same diseases my father came down with, but he was 90 years old when he got them, and he eventually died of them. But I wasn't 90 years old. I still had two daughters who were just in elementary school, and I realized, wow, you know, something, you know, I didn't want to, you know, be a casualty there. So I began looking at the science behind this, and I realized there's a growing body of research that looks at chronic disease a little bit different way than I'd been taught and the way that I was teaching in medical school. And that was that these chronic diseases, I had gout, which is a type of arthritis. I had prediabetes, which is a glucose metabolism abnormality. I had dyslipidemia, which is abnormal blood lipids. And basically, there were several diseases like that. And they were treated by the healthcare system as separate diseases. I went in and that's the way they were handled. But the new research is showing that there's actually a common basis to them. In other words, there are things like inflammation, insulin resistance, and metabolic dysfunction that affects a large percentage of the population that actually drives these diseases. And the problem is, and the fourth one I forgot to mention was hypertension, mm-hmm. elevated blood pressure. So despite the fact that these seem like very different things, you know, joint pain and hypertension or glucose abnormalities, they're actually all driven by these common factors, these inflammatory factors. And what I realized is that what conventional medicine was doing was just treating the symptoms. So I got a blood pressure medicine. It lowered my blood pressure, but it didn't change anything about the blood vessels that were causing the problem. The same thing with glucose. It lowered my glucose, but didn't change the underlying prediabetes. So what I began to find out as I studied more and more, there's growing evidence showing that you can reverse these metabolic factors, this insulin resistance and inflammation that I mentioned. But the interesting thing about it, there's not really a pill that works for those. And what works, though, is something even stronger, and that's lifestyle. So what I did was I went on a program of changing my lifestyle and doing certain things. And over time, basically, my blood pressure dropped. Everything went back to normal. My doctors couldn't believe it. They were shocked, and they eventually stopped my prescriptions because I didn't need them anymore. And now that's where I am now. But there's a fundamental misunderstanding in medicine today still that a lot of the approach is still just to treat the symptoms of the disease rather than the root cause and the basic metabolic abnormality. I mean, even a heart attack, if someone goes in for a heart attack, you know, which is caused by not enough blood getting to the muscle of the heart, they will then either have an operation for a revascularization or a stent will be put in, which just opens up the blood vessel. And everyone thinks, wow, they took care of my heart attack, which they did in a sense acutely, but it doesn't change anything of the underlying mechanism of disease that's still going on. In other words, the rest of your blood vessels are still getting worse and you haven't really corrected the root cause, which for that is also inflammation and insulin resistance as well.
I want to get into some of the lifestyle interventions you deployed to reverse some of the conditions you were suffering. But first, I want to look a little bit deeper into the book. Can you tell us about some of the lies that we can expect to read? What were the big whoppers that you told?
Sure.
And what were the implications of that being the accepted knowledge or information at the time?
Yeah, a lot of it hinges around the way our metabolism works. And that's one of the first chapters of the book is looking at metabolism. When I went to medical school, metabolism was just, it was sort of the way we handle food. You know, it was sort of a boring subject and nobody paid much attention to it. But it's actually fundamental to our health. And really in metabolism, glucose metabolism drives inflammation and drives the root cause for those four diseases I have that I have, but also for other major diseases such as Alzheimer's disease, such as cancer, such as heart attack, such as stroke. In fact, those are the main diseases that you and I and most people will eventually die of. And they are driven to a large extent by these same metabolic factors.
Looking at when you were facing those diagnoses, what lifestyle interventions did you deploy, and how did you get to the position in which you felt comfortable that was the right course of action? Because I think a lot of people face that decision of, do I need to make some lifestyle changes or do I go down the medical route and just take medicine for the rest of my life? But then there can be a lot of uncertainty and how to know which is the right approach. How did you kind of navigate that maze?
It's not easy. And I'm a professional medical person. That's what I do for a living. And it was confusing to me. It was difficult. So let me say at first, I didn't stop taking the medications until the lifestyle worked. Okay. So if someone has a heart attack, you need to go to a hospital. Yeah. If someone has cancer, you need to have cancer treatment. If you have Alzheimer's disease, well, there is no treatment. But the point is, I didn't give up modern medicine because if your blood pressure is elevated, you need a blood pressure medicine. If your glucose is elevated in diabetes, you need a medicine. So I'm not suggesting that people just throw away their pills. What I'm saying is there is an alternative to a lifetime of medications. Not for everyone, but for many of these chronic diseases, these lifestyle changes can make a difference. So,
and where did you start? Because I think most people think of lifestyle changes, I think, well, I need to maybe do a bit of exercise and change the way I eat. And that's the starting point. Was it the same for you?
Yeah, that's the problem with lifestyle recommendations. You know, everyone should, they say, eat healthy and exercise more. And that's what I was told by my doctor when I was diagnosed with hypertension. You know, I said, what can I do about this? And he said, well, take these pills. And I said, is there anything else? He said, well, maybe you should exercise more and eat better and eat healthy. And I go, okay, everybody wants to eat healthy, but there's not even a consensus on what eating healthy is. And that, you know, it's very difficult to navigate that. So I began reading the scientific literature as best I could. I interpreted it the best I could. And then I made decisions based on what I read, what I thought was the truth. I applied it to myself. But then when I started seeing results, I continued on with whether it was dietary, whether it was exercise, whether it was sleep, whether it was stress. Those are the four main areas that I looked at as far as lifestyle. And I think for me, those were the four fundamental areas that allowed me to get off these medicines and stay off these, have these diseases treated.
With the nutrition, I want to get into nutrition, obviously, into great detail. But for you, what was the starting point? What nutritional changes did you make? And how quickly did you begin to see or feel, I guess, the benefits?
Yeah, and nutrition, let me just say at the beginning, I'm the Switzerland of diets. Basically, in the past, I was a vegan for 10 years. I've tried the carnivore diet. So I'm not here to sell either a vegan or carnivore diet. In fact, I believe you can be healthy in either one if you watch, make sure you get your macronutrients and micronutrients in place. What I found most useful and kind of the common theme that worked for me was to get rid of junk food. And junk food is sort of like, you know, saying don't eat junk food. It's like saying eat healthy. So the trick is how you define junk food and what you consider to be junk food. And for me, what I found to be junk food and what was giving me these diseases in my diet so that when I gave it up, the diseases went away were the way I recognize junk food, I counsel the patients I work with is that, well, first of all, most stores that we have, most food in stores are junk food. And if it's a, like a 7-Eleven we have here in the United States or similar type, you know, fast food or convenience stores, almost all the food there is junk food. So junk food I recognize is if it comes in a box and if it's brightly colored, that's, you know, that's a sign if it has a long ingredient list. But in particular, there are three things I look for in junk food to avoid. One is sugar and refined carbohydrates. That then refined carbohydrates is like bread, starch, rice, flour, all those things. It drives inflammation, drives insulin resistance. So sugar and carbs. Second is oils and seed oils. Basically, healthy fats are very important. I mean, I grew up believing that saturated fat and butter were clogging my arteries. And many of my colleagues still believe this. But what I've come to realize, and more people are realizing, that it's actually the carbohydrates all along that were causing the problems. So carbohydrates, then seed oils we mentioned, things like canola oil, vegetable industrial oils, things that the American Heart Association lists as heart healthy. And that's a whole story.
We'll get to that in due course, I'm sure.
But yeah, seed oils, and then basically the last thing is grains. For me, grains are problematic, cereals and grains, because they, in the United States at least, glyphosate is an herbicide that's sprayed on a lot of grains, and it's problematic. But secondly, gluten is a protein in certain types of grains. But not only gluten, other proteins that are present in grains, in a large percentage of people, drive antibody reactions or inflammation to these things. So even if you don't have frank celiac disease, which is gluten intolerance, many of us still have inflammation that's driven by grains and cereals. So for me, I cut them out of my whole diet, even whole grains.
You've mentioned seed oils there, and I've seen from your work before, you list that above sugar as one of the leading causes of obesity, diabetes, a load of other health issues as well. What is it specifically about seed oils that are so bad in your view?
Yeah, the seed oil evidence, I think, is very strong. It may not be as strong as the carbohydrate, but it's still enough to convince me to stay away from them. There's a balance between omega-3 and omega-6 oils. Omega-6 oils are pro-inflammatory. They're present in the seed oils. The seed oils were recently developed in the 20th century. They weren't around 150 years ago. And somebody made the observation that most of the food we eat wasn't around 150 years ago, but most of the chronic diseases we die of weren't present in the numbers today that they 150 years ago. So the fact that it's a new manufactured type of food is problematic. But then there's scientific evidence shows that it's pro-inflammatory and actually drives inflammation. And inflammation drives insulin resistance and all those chronic diseases that I mentioned.
I wanted to get your view on the role of junk food in mental health, because it's quite clear from the research that the more junk food you eat, the more likely you're going to have negative body composition effects, increased body fat, reduced muscle mass. What about the connection in your view between eating suboptimally and then performing suboptimally? Now, I'm not talking about full mental health issues, but what's your take on how eating a diet high in junk food could potentially have issues on how somebody feels mentally?
Yeah, I think it's very important. It's a great question, and it's something that's being overlooked a lot. I mean, there's a revolution in frank mental health disease, schizophrenia, and major depressive disorder, and how these can be treated by removing junk foods from the diet. And Chris Palmer and others are having great results with that. But your question, I think, is more nuanced. It's about how does it affect everyday interactions between people, between me and my loved ones, my family, my friends, and politically across the aisle. That's become much more frosty recently. And I think you're absolutely right on. I think the junk foods are contributing to it. We're driving inflammation. We're driving changes in the brain. Junk foods, by their nature, are designed to be addictive. You know, they're designed to tap into the satiety and reward, not satiety, but reward centers in our brain to make us want to eat more of them, you know.
And this could be why, you know, we talked before we started filming about how the quickest way to start an argument on social media is to put out a view about nutrition, right? And you do have people get incredibly animated and outright angry about this. Do you think there might be a link between people who are maybe feeling angry, feeling depressed, feeling anxious? It's not necessarily down to their life circumstances. It's down to how they eat, because we know it affects your body physically. So why would it not affect it mentally? Is that something you think is worth exploring more?
Absolutely. And I mean, there are some observational studies already published on this. There's the famous Diet Coke study or the soda study where the number of sodas, either diet or regular, that children consumed was linked to violent behavior in the children. And it's an observational study, but it was controlled for age, race, socioeconomic, gender. All they controlled for as many things as they wanted to, but they still found the kids who drank more soda, there was an association, not causality, but an association with more violent behavior and all. So it's difficult to tease out causality from these things, but I think for all the reasons you've mentioned, it's definitely worth looking at.
You mentioned going into any convenience store and almost everything on the shelves or available to purchase would be classified as junk food in your book. How have we ended up here? How are we in a situation where there is such a disconnect between what people think maybe is healthy or what they should be eating and what the reality is, and living in a world where it's incredibly difficult to find and buy the kind of foods that our grandparents or people would have been eating 100 years ago?
I think it's a great question. I think there are a few answers to that. One, there are companies that made a lot of money selling addictive products that are tobacco companies. And once tobacco began to be locked down through legislation in the United States and other countries, these tobacco companies pivoted into processed foods, which basically is junk food. And they used their same skill set at marketing addictive tobacco products to adults, only with the junk food, they didn't have the age restrictions and they could market them to children as well. And they also had the convenience store delivery channels already set up. So they began filling the places that used to sell cigarettes, now sell junk food. So that was one factor, I think. And the other factor, I think, was some fundamental mistakes about low-fat diet as being useful for heart disease risk and being adopted as national health policy in the United States and other countries that really set people down the wrong path as well.
In the decades to come, when we look back at this period of time, what's going to be the kind of the tobacco controversy? What nutritional advice that is now widespread or accepted do you think we're going to look back on with the same kind of disbelief that we look back on at what the tobacco companies were getting away with? Or, you know, which could always be a borderline criminal conspiracy, right? Is there anything in the nutritional space you feel has that weight?
Well, just that sugar is accepted as a healthy food, whereas, you know, orange juice is considered to be a healthy drink. I was raised that way. My mom was a dietitian. When my children go to school today in their elementary school, for their breakfast, they're served orange juice, which is basically
like a candy bar. It's very unhealthy. It's all sugar. They're served cereal, which are grains, which is sweetened. They're served hot chocolate. I think sugar is a major factor. Seed oils also is another one that we're going to look back on and say, I can't believe that, you know, that we did this. But we have a long way to go before we get there.
We can attribute the rise in childhood obesity and other conditions, ADHD, with the change in the diet that we've had over the last 20 or 30 years. How big a role do you think is what we're feeding our kids having in some of the outcomes we're seeing, and lack of discipline, lack of educational ability, all these other problems that are huge generational issues now?
Absolutely. I think it's 100% related to that. I mean, all the diseases I've mentioned, especially diabetes, obesity, and these other chronic diseases are increasing. We're seeing diabetes, type 2 diabetes, which used to be called adult onset diabetes, we're seeing it in children now. And it's driven by eating sugar. And you can reverse type 2 diabetes. It's been shown in clinical studies by just limiting the food that causes type 2 diabetes, which is carbohydrates. And if you cut out carbohydrates, you won't get it. So I think absolutely that the obesity epidemic is driven by a fundamental misconception or a misunderstanding of obesity. And that's one of the lies in my book, sort of circle back to your question, is that a calorie is just a calorie. And people who are overweight, even today, are counseled just eat less and exercise more. So saying that obesity is a problem of eating too much food is sort of like saying that alcoholism is a problem of drinking too much alcohol. It's factually true, but it doesn't really give any insight into the causality or what causes it. And I believe, and there's growing evidence to support this, that the way to think about obesity is not a problem, not a moral failing of just because you eat too much, but it's rather a problem of eating the wrong type of food. Of the three macronutrients, fat, protein, and carbohydrates, one of them drives insulin, and insulin is a hormone that tells our body to store fat. And the one of those that mostly drives insulin is carbohydrates. So if I eat 100 calories of carbohydrates, a large percentage of that will be stored as fat because that's what it tells my body to do. If I eat 100 calories of fat, interesting, it won't be stored as fat. It will be metabolized, and that's a fundamental misconception. So it's not about eating too much. It's about eating the wrong things, and then exercising. At least in my opinion. It's very hard to exercise your way out of a bad diet. In other words, I was counseled to exercise more for my hypertension and to lose weight. How do you work up an appetite? You run around and you work out to work up an appetite, and that makes you eat more. So in my opinion, at least, I don't think exercising more and eating less is the key to obesity, but rather just avoiding the foods that drive insulin, which is carbohydrates.
Another thing, huge issue, especially around obesity, is we live in a world now, especially in the Western world, where we don't eat because we're hungry. We eat because we're bored, or we're sad, or we're anxious, or we're distracted, or because of peer pressure. How do we begin to tackle obesity as a huge health concern, not just for the individual, but for the states as well? You know, all this healthcare treatment needs to be paid for. How do we address some of the underlying causes that are responsible for obesity without just thinking we can plaster over a simple message of you need to be eating the right things? Because quite often it's not about food.
Yeah. And what you said just resonated with me about getting the habit of eating three meals a day. I was told you eat three meals a day and then you have snacks in between, and that was healthy. But it's actually not healthy, because eating itself drives inflammation. And if you eat continuously, you're driving inflammation continuously. So I dialed back my eating window. What I did was, after dinner, I brushed my teeth immediately. And because I'm basically lazy, that meant that I wouldn't eat again, because then I'd have to brush my teeth again. And then I went on and I noticed that, you know, when it was lunchtime, I go, oh, it's lunchtime. I need to get something. So I'd say, what do I want? You know, do I want a sandwich? But I wasn't really necessarily hungry. I just felt obligated to eat because I was told that, you know, lunch, breakfast is the most important meal of the day, et cetera, mm-hmm. which is, you know, not true. It's a marketing slogan. But so then I gave up breakfast and I found I didn't need it. It was fine. And then I eventually gave up lunch. Now I just eat one meal a day. And for me, I've never felt better. My mind is clear, fog, less brain fog. And for me, that works.
Is this one of the fundamental solutions, is that we need to appreciate that everyone's going to respond differently? For some people, that's going to be the optimal approach. And I think I benefit from doing something similar to you, but I know other people who will need to eat religiously. Yep. How do we begin to solve some of these problems when it seems that everyone might need a bespoke solution? It's a huge challenge, though, right?
It is. I mean, part of it is just educating people that these choices are available, that you don't have to eat all these meals, or maybe you do. And part of it is going to be all of us learning to use the tools so we can be sensitive to our body, whether it's, you know, with blood tests that we do at home with a finger stick that mm-hmm. we can get done, or with continuous glucose monitors, which it's great. In the UK, you don't need a prescription to get them, but here you do, which is in the United States, which is crazy. So I think giving people the tools, put a glucose monitor on the Apple Watch, it's coming, and the Android watches, you know.
Do you feel that's where technology can help from a nutritional point of view in a way that these kind of fitness trackers have from an activity point of view? For instance, no one was really bothered about doing 10,000 steps a day until you had a number that told you whether or not you'd hit your target. And if you hit your target, you get a little tick where you feel a bit better. Is that, can we expect the same kind of technological breakthroughs to help from a nutritional standpoint?
I think I'm very hopeful with the glucose monitors on smartwatches that will get people thinking about these glucose spikes that basically damage their blood vessels and create aging in all of them. Because right now people aren't aware of it. They're not tuned into it. So I think that ketone monitors also on the watches and more sophisticated analytics that will allow us to develop, as you say, those bespoke approaches to our fitness, it's going to be key.
The Tufts University Food Compass, right? We talk about educating people, and that's a very famous bit of research that came out and told people what to eat. But it was funded by big food companies who obviously had an agenda. And some of the results of that, breakfast cereal at the top, meat, cheese, eggs towards the bottom, is, from my view, the wrong kind of advice of what people should be eating. How do we begin to steady the ship when it comes to nutritional information, when there is so much out there from trusted bodies, from kind of government-backed regulatory bodies, from, you know, the American Heart Association you mentioned? How do we begin to overturn decades of wrong or even damaging advice that's got an official stamp on it?
It's challenging. I mean, we mentioned about the American Heart Association saying that canola oil, that seed oil, is heart healthy, or that cereals are heart healthy. We're seeing the same thing from the American Diabetic Association, which is the voice to diabetics all over the world. And it tells them it's okay to eat sugar, just cover it with insulin. In other words, take more insulin. And the insulin basically makes people worse for type 2 diabetes. But the American Diabetic Association is funded by companies that sell insulin and do other things. So there are both intentional and unintentional perverse incentives, financial incentives that drive these companies. And people need to be aware of it, and they need to, you know, look cautiously at advice like the Tufts University study, if it's funded by General Mills and these big food companies who obviously have a bias or an agenda from that happening.
We'll even look at politicians, though, with the influence of lobbyists. I think it's probably a bigger issue here in the US than it perhaps is in Europe. But how do we fight on a level playing field here, where you've got big, you know, we'll get to big pharma in a second, but with big food, with the tobacco companies, the influence they had, government elected employees maybe taking some of influence from these lobbyists. It's a battle we can never win, is it?
Well, I mean, hopefully we can make progress, but it, like you say, it's very challenging. I mean, even the healthcare system, type 2 diabetes is one of the main drivers of disease that we're seeing now. It didn't used to be, but now sadly it is. And type 2 diabetes is a disease that it has been shown by controlled clinical trials. You can reverse it in many patients, most patients, by eliminating carbohydrates, just controlling the diet. And at the medical schools where I've worked, I asked my colleagues, I said, you know, why do you give these people insulin? Why not just do the diet? And somebody pointed out, he said, you know what the number one cause of amputations that this hospital does and hospitals all around the world is? It's diabetes, type 2 diabetes. Do you know what the number one cause of renal transplants and all the dialysis and renal failure at this hospital and all around the world? It's type 2 diabetes. You know, the number one cause of blindness, it's diabetes. So do you want, it was sort of a cynical view, and I don't think it's necessarily a conscious, but all of these things are linked, and there's a lot of financial wheels turning as well on this. And I agree with you, it's a challenge. I don't think it's insurmountable, but we start with education and let people, just like we're doing now, let people understand what's going on and what the possibilities are.
Does the education have to begin with the medical profession, with doctors? Because a very cynical view would be they're in the pocket of big pharmaceuticals, so it's in the interest of them to have somebody on drugs for the rest of their life rather than seek cure. But from a very sympathetic view, I'm sure you have colleagues who simply it's not what they were taught, and the curriculum, the qualifications haven't changed since, so they're still being told incorrect information. How do we fix that from a medical training point of view to get good information in the hands of the people that need to use it and can influence patients?
Yeah, it's a great question. The healthcare system in the United States is, and really everywhere, is driven by diagnoses. You know, your blood sugar goes up to a certain point, and then you're diagnosed with prediabetes, and then you're diagnosed with diabetes. You have a little brain fog, and it goes along for a while, and then you're diagnosed with Alzheimer's, with cognitive impairment, and this sort of thing. And the problem is the insurance, the payment, the whole system only kicks in when you're diagnosed, when you're given a diagnosis. And what we're finding is that these diseases, like diabetes, like Alzheimer's disease, are present for decades, 10 or 20 years before they enter the medical system with a diagnosis. And that's the time that they can be treated very early on. But the problem is, if I'm a doctor and I can't say that, you know, your glucose is going up, but you haven't crossed the threshold where I can bill the insurance company or, you know, whatever the payment system is, even with a Kaiser or a, you know, nationalized health system, there's still thresholds. And it's a way of looking at disease that's different. And looking at prevention starting earlier is really the secret, in my opinion. So for me, I think the key is going to the patients now and educating them. I mean, I've spent my career educating doctors, and, you know, maybe I just didn't do a very good job of it. But seriously, I think right now, I think the exciting thing is if you teach the patients about this, they can do things that the doctors can't do because the system doesn't allow them to do that. They can't prescribe certain things. They can't take certain actions because the insurance and the incentives are not aligned for it. So from my point of view, at least, the exciting thing is going out and going directly to the people and helping to educate them.
How excited are you by the prospect of what artificial intelligence can do in this space? Because as you said, if we're waiting to a point where someone has to tick a number of boxes because they're already that far down the path, how do you see the role of AI being able to identify very early stages of potential problems in a way that no doctor or even a patient would be able to recognize themselves?
I'm extremely bullish on AI. I think it's going to be revolutionary in ways that we don't even see it coming. You know, just like, you know, we didn't necessarily see the internet coming and the revolution before that happened. And so I think AI, just the use case you say, taking massive amounts of data, even, you know, Fitbit data, exercise data, how I talk on the phone, all these things that no single human physician could ever hope to process, and then come up with an integrative, personalized, bespoke health plan. Mm-hmm. I think that's really the future.
And what does the future look like? Being optimistic now, I promised that we would get to this point. You know, looking into the crystal ball, what would you like to see? How do you hope, in, with the best will in the world, that the world is going to look in maybe 5-10 years' time with the combination of all the things we've talked about, better education, AI, and a greater understanding of nutrition and the individual? What does a really positive future look like for you?
Well, I think that people will understand disease better and understand the lifestyle choices, so that when they do something, and it is a choice, we all get to choose every day how we're going to make our lifestyle, but people will be informed so that they know by a given choice about exercising or steps or sleep or nutrition that they are indeed affecting themselves directly in their health. And I think I'm optimistic. I think if people are aware of it and they understand what's going on, they will choose to be healthy. They want to see their grandkids. They don't want to have an amputation or a renal dialysis if they can avoid it. So I'm optimistic that we're going to see basically junk food sales will decrease, because we all get to vote every time we buy something, you know, either buy it or not. And my optimistic future will be that these chronic diseases will be decreasing, people will be living healthier, longer, and they'll be embracing these healthy lifestyle choices that you are doing so much to promote with your organization.
There's a lot of press speculation about tech billionaires investing in these startups in Silicon Valley aimed at longevity research specifically. Obviously, it's hugely exciting. It's very easy to get caught up in all of the advantage that this kind of research is hopefully going to lead to. Do you feel that enough conversational weight is being given to some of the potential implications of everyone living longer, the impact on healthcare, on every single facet of how we live our lives? That's something that doesn't seem to be talked about as much. Should it be?
It absolutely should be. One key thing with living longer, though, is going to be a decrease in chronic diseases. We're not going to live longer unless we take care of heart disease and diabetes and these other things. So concomitant with that will be increasing the health span. With increasing lifespan, nobody wants to live longer 10 more years in a nursing home. That it's got to be with increasing the health span. So that's the important factor that I think we're going to see that effect. But, you know, should people retire at age 65 if they're going to live another 40 years? I mean, my mom died when she was in her 90s, but she kept working till she was in her 80s. But we may have to rethink how society works if people live much longer. And it's an important question we don't know the answers to.
How far away do you believe we are from seeing some really seismic breakthroughs in this space? Is it 5 years? Are we 20 years away? What's your feel? And obviously, you're immersed in this and have a lot of friends and colleagues who work in this space. Where are we at, and how close are we to something really quite incredible?
Well, the longevity drugs, we've seen in animal models, they can increase their lifespan by 20 to 30%. And this one of these drugs, rapamycin, works in all the way from yeast to fruit flies to worms to mice, and even to, there's some work on companion dogs that are being done. This is one of the drugs humans are taking now. The problem is, it could be having that effect. We just don't know it because we can't run the controlled study in humans. You know, ask me, does rapamycin work? And I'll tell you, well, check back with me in 30 years. Tell you, right?
A lot of people are obviously looking for kind of the magic bullet for things like longevity. But you've tweeted before about the real key to longevity is, you know, living a life with a sense of purpose. It's community, it's human connections. In the grand scheme of things, is this where most of us should be focusing our attention? It's not looking for a hack or a magic bullet. It's kind of taking a moment to smell the roses and appreciate what we've got around us. Is that where maybe some of us are missing the bigger picture?
Yeah, I think having purpose in our life, having fulfillment is key. And we can't ask for anything more than that. Without purpose, our life doesn't have any meaning, and it's not worth living. So absolutely. And there are effects on stress. There's effects on the brain of just having a purpose. Mark Hyman famously said that find something in your life that you're willing to die for, and then live for it. And that's purpose.
We've spoken about sugar and its potential negative impacts on health. We've also spoken about how governments can take more responsibility in helping the population be healthier. Sugar taxes are something that gets a lot of attention, have been implemented in certain territories. What's your view on a sugar tax? Is this a shortcut to success or ultimately a road to ruin?
I'm not an expert in public policy, and I'm always afraid of unintended consequences when certain things happen like that. But I think the key is educating people and making them aware of the potential harm that sugar has. There is one thing that's happening. You know, decades ago, when cigarettes used to be everywhere in the movie theaters, in the hospital, in the operating rooms, everywhere, and then gradually a few hospitals outlawed vending machines for cigarettes, and then it basically became a nationwide or a worldwide thing. Right now, what's happening is that certain hospitals are outlawing sugar drinks in the hospital, like UC San Francisco, and a few other hospitals around the country. And this may be a bellwether for a future movement where it follows what happened with tobacco, which what happens with these sugar drinks.
So it's going to be, if I can sum up, more of a war of attrition than an outright blow for victory. It's going to be something that we have to do in stages, like tobacco. In certain places, you're no longer allowed to buy it. Advertising was then banned. Maybe taxes were then increased. It's going to be a step-by-step approach with sugar, just as it was with tobacco.
I suspect it will be. I mean, look at the World Cup. Who's the sponsor of the World Cup? You know, the soda, sugar water companies are extremely powerful, extremely large, and have a great deal of influence. So I suspect it's going to be, as you say.
Thank you for listening to the Unfiltered podcast. If you've got this far, I hope you won't mind if I ask you to leave a 5-star review when you get the chance. We'd really appreciate it. And don't forget, you can access all of our exclusive Unfiltered video interviews and features at unfilteredonline.com and the Unfiltered Extra YouTube channel. See you next time.